The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my time travelling friends. It's Sarah back with another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Before we put the spotlight on our historic property of the month and what a gem it is, I have a couple of updates for you. Well, first of all, I'm pleased to say that by the time this podcast drops, it will be officially spring here in the UK. And it certainly looks so outside of my window. All the spring bulbs, the daffodils are coming through and I've seen my first lambs in the field, and that always raises the spirits. Although I have to say, the weather needs to get on the right page. Oh, it's been gloomy and cold and rainy for so many weeks now. I am just keeping my fingers crossed that we have a beautiful, warm, sunny summer. Not least because in May, I will be setting off with another keen group of Tudor travellers as part of our tour under Simply Tudor Tours. Of course, this is Anne and Elizabeth, mother, daughter, traitors, queens, when we'll be visiting some amazing places associated with these two ladies and diving deep into the lives and the connections between the two of them. Well, that gets underway in mid-May, and that one is fully booked, but I just wanted to take a moment to remind you guys, in fact, we now have only three spaces left on our September tour, The Rise and Fall of Anne Boleyn. So if you are thinking of joining me in person and having a real adventure of a lifetime, then you need to hop over to Simply Tudor Tours at simplytudortours.com. I'll put the link in the description associated with this podcast for that particular tour. In other news here at the Tudor Travel Guide, this month sees the opening up of a lot of content that has previously been behind a paywall here at the Tudor Travel Guide, at least for the last couple of years, as part of my membership, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England. For various decisions, I've made the decision to close the membership, which means that all the detailed itineraries, progresses, the world of Thomas Cromwell, Mary Queen of Scots, travel itineraries, my growing portfolio of Tudor tombs, the map of the interactive map of Tudor locations up and down the UK, all of these things, all of these resources are now going to be available to everyone. So if you haven't been part of the membership over the last couple of years, there will be a lot of material for you to explore and enjoy. And if you have been a member and been supporting my work over the last couple of years financially, once again, I want to give you a massive thank you. Huge gratitude for me for being with me along that journey. It has meant the world to me. But of course, things move on and there are new adventures. Now, that is not to say, of course, that The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England, which is my long-term project to create the most comprehensive guide to exploring Tudor places around the UK, is in any way diminished. Not at all. I am continuing my research and my writing, but from now on, it will be available to everyone. And then hopefully at some point, I'll be aggregating all that material together into a book. All right, that is the end of the news update from the Tudor Travel Guide. It is now time to go time travelling. Well, I think I introduced the property that we are looking at today on location pretty well, so I'm not going to spend too much time doing that. just to say that this was an adventure for me. It was a place I had never been to before, and so it was with keen anticipation that I made my way through the English countryside to visit Helen's Manor House. It's a real little hidden gem, and it's a place you may not have heard of. And if so, then I'm delighted to be able to bring its stories and its history to you today. It is full of history, simply oozes history over many, many centuries, and it is full of the most fascinating and, as you will hear, interesting stories. Just before we start, a quick reminder that there is a show notes page associated with this podcast where you will be able to see some images of the places and the artifacts that we are discussing. So that is included in the description associated with this episode. Do check that out. So, my friends, with that, I give you Helen's. Welcome, my friends, to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. It's Sarah back, and this time you find me. Oh, spring is certainly springing today. We are lucky. The sky is blue, the sun is out, snowdrops and daffodils abound, and I am so happy to be able to bring you to Herefordshire for this episode, and to a place I've had my eye on visiting for a long time. I've been following the account on Instagram, and therefore urge you to do the same, of Helen's Manor, which has looked utterly delightful, intriguing, quirky, and perhaps one of those places that maybe you haven't heard of. And so my mission today is to find out all about this wonderful country manor house and its very, very long history. And to be our guide today, I'm standing here with Sash Giles. Hello, Sash.
Hello.
Welcome to the show today.
Welcome to Helen's.
Oh, thank you so much. And you're going to be telling us about the very long history of the house and also some of the tales and fables associated with it. And I think that's perhaps what makes this particular episode a little bit different to some of the others that we've done before, and intriguing, because there are so many stories that have grown up around this house that come from one particular owner.
That's right, yep. So Malcolm Munty, he buys the house in the early 1940s and really sets about making it into a home. He's absolutely captivated by British history, and particularly local history, and he finds these snippets of connections to Helen's and brings them all together into this woven tapestry of a place.
And I think perhaps one or two people, particularly if they've done any kind of digging around artefacts associated with the Tudor period, may well have come across something called, it's Anne Boleyn's like bathroom set, right?
That's right, yes.
And I remember coming across and thinking, what? Anne Boleyn's bathroom set? And so we're going to be coming back to this, but I just want to whet people's appetite to the fact that there are some intriguing stories, and we're here to perhaps understand more about where those stories have come from and maybe debunk a few myths, but understand that actually that's part of the rich tapestry and heritage of a house like this, which has been here since, well, pre-Norman invasion, right?
So we claim to be one of the longest continuously occupied houses in Britain. And we think that people have been living here at Helen's for at least 1,000 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And that is its other kind of claim to fame, isn't it, really? And you've brought me into the physic garden here to start our story, because one of the things you soon see about Helen's, and I'm going to do my best, dear listeners, and we are going to do our best, aren't we, Sash,
yeah,
to describe what we're seeing, because in a beautiful way, it's a real hodgepodge which shows the layers of history, the architectural history of the house. And you brought me to this particular garden because of what?
Well, this aspect of the house probably shows most clearly the multiple layers of occupation and the way that people have taken different materials and different fabrics and worked with them, maybe out of necessity or maybe as fashions have changed. And you start from the crunchy gravel of the Physic Garden, and you look down at some moss-covered steps, and you see this very wide, broad door. And at the bottom, you've got some sort of very sharp pieces of wood pointing upwards, and the whole thing is studded with nails, and you've got this beautiful kind of gnarled, rusted door knocker right in the centre. And then as you begin to look to the left and the right and above, there's this quite scarred, quite patchy sandstone arch, and then a bricked-up window. And then as your eye travels up to the left, you've got this possibly slightly spurious piece of carving with a figure slightly crushed under a corbel. And then you've got a sash window, and let your eye travel all the way up these two huge brick chimney stacks, and then this Flemish gable in the centre. And so all of this represents fashion and change and occupation, but also local materials. Because the bricks that the house was built in, we think around 40 years before Hampton Court Palace was using brick, which was a very novel material at the time, there was brickworks at Helens, and we still have the clay pond from which the bricks were made.
Oh, brilliant.
And many of the timbers in the house, so lots of elm and lots of oak, actually came from Hall Wood, which is on our estate, and it is one of the oldest continuously worked woodlands in Britain.
Wow, fantastic. I love that. That's wonderful. We're going to be looking at some of the other sort of external features of the house, but also going inside and exploring some of the places and mm-hmm. spaces associated. Because am I right in saying that some of, you know, your interiors also reflect the changing styles?
That's right, yes. So we've got very few interior records in terms of, we've never been in country life as far as I'm aware, so we don't have that photographic record to compare to. We've got a few letters which make some quite illuminating comments, but mostly we're hunting down with the knowledge that we have, with the knowledge of our friends and colleagues and people who visit us, to come and help us really unpick the architectural changes that have happened in the house. But it's all part of the fun of Helens, because it's layered and there's some objects that grab your eye, and it turns out you're not quite looking at what you think you're looking at. Okay. So for a very small place, there's a lot to get really involved in.
Okay, brilliant. And do you think that we should continue our story of the origins of the house out here, or is there a space inside that would be maybe an interesting place to talk about the early medieval story?
Well, we can do both. So we can walk around the outside of the house, taking in the east front and the beautiful view down to the Malvins, and then we can come to rest in the courtyard, because there's lots to talk about in there before we go into the house.
Okay, let's do that then. So lead the way, lead the way. were walking, Sash, maybe you could just describe those people. And I try and do this in our episodes, and listeners who tune in regularly will know. For those people who are maybe not so familiar with English geography, where are we? Where is Herefordshire? And can you give us some pointers of some main towns and cities that are around us?
So Herefordshire sits in a part of the country called the Marches, and this was a long line which essentially divided Wales from England, and it was a hugely contested borderland. So lots of houses were built, forming a kind of defensive wall, and trusted families of the monarchs over a period of hundreds of years were installed to essentially fortify and occupy these houses. And Helens was one of those. We're 15 minutes away from Ledbury, half an hour away from Hereford. We're near Ludlow, Leinster, Ross-on-Wye. So we're sort of in this hotbed of places. And I only recently found out that the only reason that Oxford University is in Oxford and not Hereford is because at the time that Oxford was built, Hereford was essentially a war zone. Nobody wanted to put seed money into Hereford. So I've now begun to see this place as kind of like Texas between the US and Mexico, which has completely changed my view of this rural, bucolic,
idyll.
Quite exactly, exactly.
But,
you know, we've got some stories to share that will maybe chill the blood of anybody who wants to visit about just the kind of things that have happened here at Helens and beyond.
Now, we've walked into this gorgeous courtyard, and you're going to tell me all about that. But as we do, I just wanted to go back right to the beginning, because if you do a quick search on Helens Manor and you get your Wikipedia article up, one of the first things you see is there seems to be connection to Saxon royalty. So Harold Godwinson, who was famously shot through the eye at the Battle of Hastings. And this was, of course, the point that William the Conqueror invaded England and became the first Norman king. So he owned this area, he owned these lands?
That's right. So there was this history of nobility being granted the right to lands. And sometimes that would mean that they never actually visited the place, they just had the right to collect the rents and the tithes and the places. And the family that's associated with this house is the de Balans. And their major claim to fame is that they witnessed the signing of one of the versions of the Magna Carta. And then through their line, it passed to a steward called Walter de Hellion, and his name was corrupted into Helens because of their long occupation here.
So that's where we come to. Now, you've brought me into a lovely courtyard, which again is clearly a whole mishmash and range, a smorgasbord of architectural styles here. Can you unpick
exactly
some of this for me, please?
So we've just walked through an enormous pair of metal-covered sort of courtyard gates. And we've walked under quite an agricultural-looking porch. And then as we look to the left-hand side, we've got this sort of slightly strange crenellated building, which speaks to that fortified history of the house. But actually, this bit was a gallery built by Malcolm Munty in the 1970s to house a collection of paintings. And then as you sweep your eye across to the right, there's this sort of roofed range with a dormer window, and then this triple height tower, which is known as the Audley Tower, because they're another family that's associated with the house. And we've got this brick and these exposed oak beams, diamond lattice windows, and then some stone effect coins at the corners where the bricks turn the corner. And that was fashioned in the sort of 1640s. And then if you sweep your eye further round, you can see behind a large brick chimney, a blocked up door, which was once an entrance into the house, and then another blocked up window. And we're not really sure about the purpose of that, because actually at the time when the window tax was being implemented, the man responsible for collecting the taxes lived here. So it seems strange that he would have publicly evaded the tax that he was meant to collect. However, there was a bomb which landed at Helens in the Second World War.
Oh.
So it is possible that actually Malcolm took the opportunity to kind of change the interior aspect of the courtyard to reflect some history, which actually, little did he know, kind of contradicted one of the former occupants' occupations.
That's really interesting. So So before we go any further, I just want to remind you all, dear listeners, as ever, there is a show notes page and we should be putting up some images, photos of the things that we're busy describing here today at Helen's. Now, one of the things as you were talking there, Sash, is I was just thinking, what do we know of the original floor plan? Obviously, there have been many changes over the centuries, but if we go back to the medieval period, what do we know of what Helen's looked like? How big was the house? What were some of the principal chambers? Was this the main entrance somewhere into a great hall? What do we know and what do we not know?
So as we look from the courtyard, you can see this sort of foundation range of stone. So if we take that as genuine, you'll see that the house had a rectangular shape, which has then grown out with a wing at right angles. And there is an understanding that there was a monastic foundation living here. So it's likely that there would have been spaces for prayer, some kind of a hospital, spaces for growing, for working food, a communal space for food, and also places where monks could retreat in dormitories. So if we take that as the original shape of the house, there would have been a great hall where the music room is at the moment. And we'll talk about that more when we go inside. But actually, that's really hard to understand from the present aspect of the house, because it currently looks very domestic rather than having any kind of religious origin.
Yeah, yes, it absolutely does. OK, well, thank you for that. And we will be going in a minute, but I'm keeping you outside. It's quite, despite the blue skies,
isn't it?
It's quite fresh in the air. So we will go inside in a moment just to warm up, if nothing else. But another really interesting thing that I came across in my sort of prep for coming here is I talked about the Saxon royal connections, but then we roll forward into the medieval period and you have quite an important event and some really important people gather here.
We have. We've got a rare instance of a documentary source which backs up the story. So we have a connection to James Audley, who's a companion of the Black Prince, and they fought together at Crecy and Poitiers. And a member of the Audley family married Roger Mortimer's sister, Isolde. And at that time, Helen's welcomed Roger and Isabella, the Queen of England, and her young son, Edward, the future Edward III. And they were actually engaged in a coup to overthrow Isabella's husband, Edward II. And it was here at Helen's that the young Prince Edward received the Great Seal of England after Edward II's abdication.
So that's quite exciting. We have a major royal event happening here during the medieval period, and I love that bit of history. And of course, those people who have been following the podcast will know we've actually done a podcast at Berkeley Castle, which was where Edward II was imprisoned and said to have been murdered. So if you wanted to follow that storyline, you could search for the Tudor Travel Guide in Berkeley Castle, and I'm sure you will find that podcast there. OK, lovely. Now, is it time to go inside?
Indeed.
Do you think
it
so?
It really is. So we walk through the courtyard, which is cobbled, past a very ancient well,
yes,
which
lovely.
Was only uncovered a couple of decades ago. And it's said to be as deep as the tallest chimney stack that you can see just to the right of it as you go into the house. So that gives you some impression of just how deep and ancient that well is. And we still use it. Still use it now for watering the garden.
Yeah. How wonderful.
So as we come into the house, we sort of go forward a few hundred years to this a very ancient looking gnarled door, which has a series of holes in it, which are said to have resulted from shots fired during the Civil War when some Puritan soldiers entered the house. It's very pockmarked, very ancient.
I love an old door. I think we're going to have to definitely get a picture of this door.
Yeah,
this is beautiful.
Multiple keyholes, at least three. Four or five.
That's fantastic.
And it is possible that that door has been reused from somewhere else on the site, but it's certainly got some age.
It's definitely seen a few
it has.
It's seen better days, but it's
heavily repaired.
Gorgeous. Go on, let's hear the
come
noise.
Come inside. There you go.
Oh, I love her. The sound of the latch. Oh, wow.
Thank you.
Now, I've never been to Helen's before, so everything I am seeing here today, and you will hear my genuine reaction.
First time.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Tell us where we are, because this is this feels like a really ancient place. It's almost like time has stood still in here.
It does, and it's probably worth saying that if you come in anything like the winter months, it's no warmer in here than it is outside. I can see my breath in the air. Very sorry about that. So this is the stone hall, and it does feel ancient, partly because of the materials that the room's made of. The floor is stone flags. There's a few textiles in here, but they don't really absorb the sound. But the dominating feature of the room is probably this rather enormous fireplace. So you've got a sort of hood that nearly goes up to the beamed ceiling. And on the top of it, you can just make out the feathers of the Prince of Wales.
Yes.
And his motto, Icdean I serve. And that speaks to that connection with not only the Black Prince, but also the blind king of Bohemia. So there's this story that he rode into battle strapped between two other soldiers, and the prince was so impressed by this act of valour and bravery and leadership that he adopted John's feathers as his own. Now, it's likely that Malcolm actually installed this entire fire surround, and I would dearly love to find some photographs that say that that is older, that it is older. But it's likely that this is a fabulous confection of architectural salvage, because as we guide our eye down from this heavily blackened overmantel with this pretty illegible cartouche in the centre, some slightly Maltese sort of crosses with some fleur-de-lis. As we come down to the side, you've got these heavily worn sort of caryatids, which look like they have maybe been outside for a very long time. But as you look closer, it has all the appearance of kind of concrete, which has been applied. So I think what we're seeing is this really skillful intervention that instantly makes you feel that this room has this great age and great antiquity, and it kind of whets your appetite for picking up the cues that are around the room as to other stories. And Malcolm's dressed the room with lots of pieces of arms and armour, and also a nod to his own military background. So Malcolm was of English and Swedish heritage, but actually served in Norway in the Second World War, and he was a spy. And that's why we have
really?
The Norwegian flag hanging here.
I was going to say, what is the Norwegian flag doing here?
Yeah,
how fascinating.
So, the story that I've been told is that Malcolm left the service under a slight cloud because he was involved in actually derailing the wrong train. Malcolm served with honour. And, you know, was almost certainly instrumental in preserving lots of lives that we'll probably never know the full background of. But the stress and the trauma of his service was one of the many reasons why he chose to come to Helen's in the early 1940s.
I see. Do you think he had PTSD then?
I think so. He did suffer a head wound, and this feels like a place of retreat, both here in the house that the family used to own in London, Southside. And that's probably why he chose to spend his time crafting stories, taking refuge in history. And to me, that's one of the most generous things that Malcolm did. As part of his recovery, you could completely understand if he'd retreated and wanted to keep the house to himself, whereas he and Adam, at the end of Malcolm's life, decided to open the house to others who now also seek solace and peace and refuge here in this incredible environment.
It's a really interesting room because, as I said, as you come in, it feels really ancient. And it is, isn't it? The room is ancient. But the more you look, the more you do see bits of concrete and things that, like, those pillars look very modern, and you're like, no.
What's happening here?
So it makes it fascinating, but somehow he has managed to do this while making it feel as though the medieval owners have just left.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite clever.
Well, thank you. I'm sure it'd be very pleased.
Because I can be a bit of a snob when it comes. house.
Oh, we all are. So the room has this render on the walls, which is actually starting to fail a little bit. So it's got a slightly lived-in look. There's some staining on the walls from the fire and from some damp ingress. The textiles, they're stable, but they're visibly darkened by age, by smoke and all kinds of other pollutants. But he's brought together little nods to what Malcolm understood about the previous use of the room. So in the medieval period, this would have been a semi-public space in which people would come to pay their rents, but also could come to in the hope of hearing justice being served. So Malcolm's erected this tableau to the left of the fireplace from this reddish orange faded damask, which forms a canopy from the ceiling behind a table, and hanging in front of the canopy is an oval picture of Justice with her sword. And if you allow your eye to travel down, it's in front of the canopy, there are two chairs embroidered with Florentine Bargello, and in front of that is a very large stone table, which is split across into three pieces. Mm-hmm. So this is the mensa, and you can take your pick as to what this is. Is this an ancient relic of the monastic occupation of Helens, or something local?
Yeah.
Was it found? Was it dined at by any of our royal visitors? Was it damaged in these three parts by the bomb which fell at Helens in the Second World War? Or is it a modern piece of salvage in which somebody has carved four Maltese crosses in each corner, which give you the impression that, and one in the centre, four or five crosses on the potential altar. So you can kind of take your pick as to which of those you feel it is. But it certainly dominates the room and draws the eye.
Sort of reminds me of sort of the saying, I can be anything you want me to be, baby.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the family motto roughly translates to, because it pleases me. And you can take that any way that you like as well.
That's brilliant. I love it. But it's great that we know, I was going to ask you, you answered the question, that we do know what this room was originally used for. So, yeah.
One of its uses.
Yeah,
certainly. The ceiling's a later replacement, and you can see that most clearly when you look to the right of the fireplace. And as those columns travel to the top, that's your first glimpse that maybe something slightly more modern is happening in here. And we've got the remains of what may have been a minstrel's gallery up there. And that's where the beams continue, and it can be accessed from the spiral staircase, which is housed within the tower, which we call the Audley Tower.
Wonderful. And before we go, she's so beautiful. So we've got a bust. Everything I come towards now in Helens, I'm like, isn't it? Whatever it is, it's a very pretty bust of a medieval, I'd say 15th century lady. Is it or is it a copy?
So we think this is a head and shoulders bust of a woman. She's got dark hair that's gathered around the crown of her head in a ribbon, and she's wearing a red and gold dress with a sort of gem in the centre, and she kind of looks a little bit like a reliquary. So this might have a religious origin, or it might be a portrait bust, but it certainly does bear comparison with an example that's in the V&A, and she is meant to be a member of the Sforza family from Milan.
Right, it's beautiful anyway. Good. Okay, so where do we need to go next, Ash?
So let's go up the stairs.
Okay.
So we're going to go up the pretty ancient stairs. So twisting spiral stairs of wood with this incredible post that travels all the way up to the top of the tower. I think it's in three pieces, but it's sort of chamfered on the sides. It's been oiled heavily over the years, and it bears the marks of lots of insect activity.
Oh, yes. So big piece of oak, or three pieces of oak.
Yeah, that have been bonded together.
Nice straight oak. So where were we? We were sort of talking about Roger Mortimer and Isabella and Edward III receiving the Great Seal here. So we're sort of in, I think we're in the 1300s. So what happens then in terms of from that point forward, in terms of the family history and the social history of the house?
So the Hellion family are living here as stewards, and then they intermarry with the Walwyn family, and then they're here for the next couple of hundred years. So that's, you'll see their name locally and attached to lots of the stories as we're on this floor of the house. So as you come up the spiral stairs, you come out onto a lobby, and that's when we start to display some of our early Tudor material. We've got a couple of portraits out there. One of them is by the Circle of Robert Peake. And then you come into this room, which is called Queen Mary's Room.
Okay, so this is one of our first things you come across if you're interested in Tudor history. You're doing a bit of digging, you'll come across this Mary's Room, and that always piques you to Mary. Mm-hmm. Mary, Queen Mary, came here to Helen's. Tell us about the room and the space we're in, first of all.
So you come through a fairly low door onto some quite uneven floor surfaces.
Yeah,
it's kind of hard for me to remember because I've got muscle memory now, but the whole house, it kind of feels like you're in a ship. You know, that you could roll a marble and you wouldn't actually know where it was going to go. So we come into this room and it's painted this deep wine red colour, and your eye is immediately drawn up to this white painted plaster ceiling with lots of soft curving ribs, and then this projecting detail in the centre, which the longer I've lived in Herefordshire, I've started to notice this motif, which it kind of looks like a cross between a flower and a fruit. Mm. And I've seen it at the Black and White House in Hereford and out at Abbey Door. And depending on what you believe is the origin of this story, you might think that it's either a lily or a pomegranate, because the story for a long time was that Princess Mary, daughter of Henry VIII, when living in Ludlow, visited this house. And so there was this mad scramble to make this room fit for a princess. So along...
Could you just highlight to us where Ludlow is and you know, what Mary was doing there?
So Ludlow is currently around an hour north of Muchmarkle. And she was living in Ludlow, but also in Wales when she was Princess of Wales, because it was expected for a time that she would actually potentially, very easily, become the next monarch. And obviously we know that had a slightly more complicated journey than perhaps was expected. So the family here were Catholic, so they were strong Mary supporters. So it makes sense that they may have welcomed her, or certainly would have hoped to have welcomed her. And that would have necessitated some changes in the house to have made it fit for her arrival. So along with the ceiling, over the fireplace, there's a plaster mantle which appears to bear the arms of Mary. So you've got the M and the R, you've got the lion and the dragon and her garter around the outside, and then the portcullis and the combined Tudor rose on the right-hand side. So the clues are kind of all there.
Everything you would want to see from a good bit of Tudor heraldry.
If you'd done your homework and you wanted to make it look like this room had been made to welcome a princess, this is probably what you would have done, and that is probably what Malcolm did. So he bought the house from a lady called Helena Glycombe. And she was an artist, and she lived here with her friend Nina. And they had an amazing backstory as well. I wish we had time to get into it, but Google them if you're interested. But she writes in a letter to one of the previous occupants, something like, so what do you reckon to Malcolm's medieval interventions? And okay, we think that she's talking about this room. However, I think most people would walk in and believe that they were looking at a genuine Tudor ceiling. You know, the lime coating has the right colour and the right texture, and all the little ribs, you know, they're thin, but they're not obviously machined.
Yes.
So somebody with great skill has... Yeah. done this, and it's not to detract from anything that Malcolm did. It's all part of that charm and his love for the place, that he wanted to bring all of those stories into this place so that people could enjoy them as much as he did.
It might be a good time just to ask about sort of the records that you do or don't have at Helen's, and also, has there been any thorough architectural research, you know, what kind of dendrochronology might have been done, you know, to test the different ages of the house. It'd be really interesting to hear what's been done, what's not been done, and what do you know and what don't you know.
So there are some scholarly articles about the development of Helens, and they all broadly agree that there has been a long history of occupation here and phases of redevelopment in the 1400s, the 1600s and the 1800s. There hasn't been a very planned phase of testing. We have a really good relationship with University College, who each summer bring a team of research students here and they focus on different topics. So they have done some testing. But I think in some ways there was a reluctance maybe to dig too deep in case it made people think less of the place. But I think actually things have moved on now in that we can see this all part of the story of the place. And it speaks to the skill of the people who've been here before. It speaks to
That's our soundman making creaking around on the floor.
We've done so well so far. It's a very creaky house. But also this room is the one with the most documented reports of hauntings.
Oh, I want to come on to the hauntings. Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you reminded me, because you've got at least a couple of very notable stories.
Yes.
Let's get one of them out there. Tell us about how haunted this room is.
Okay, so this takes us back to the Catholic connection. And the story goes, it relates to those holes in the front door from the courtyard, that the Catholic family who lived here, they had left a Catholic priest here to kind of mind the house, and he was an elderly man. And this is reported in the Gloucester Rolls, so there certainly does seem to be some truth in whatever resulted next. So the Puritans break into the house, they've come from Ledbury where they've caused all kinds of chaos, and they find this elderly man here. And he's run upstairs, up the spiral stairs, and he's trying to get onto the next floor up, where it was believed that there was some kind of a priest hide or an escape route where he could then get out onto the roof to a place of safety. However, he doesn't make it, and he is killed in this room. And this graphic description of him being speared to death and looking like a porcupine.
Oh.
So really horrible.
So that actually did happen, because it was in the Gloucester Rolls.
And that did happen here.
Oh.
So a few people have reported some things in this room which might make you think that there is a restless spirit here. So one of the stories is that people hear in the middle of the night the sound of running feet running from one side of the room to the other, you know, in a sort of panic state. And it was reported in the 1930s that a young man was staying here and was so disturbed after only one night in this room that he telegraphed to his family to say, "Can you phone me urgently? Because I need to leave. I can't stay here another night, and you need to help me come up with a reasonable excuse." Simon Callow has stayed here.
Oh, really?
And said, "I'm not staying in that room again."
Really?
A young lady was on a tour and had been told or asked by the tour guide, "Could you close, whoever's last, could you close the door behind you?" And after the sort of second or third time of not doing it, her dad told her off, and she said, "Yes, but there's somebody behind me." And she kept saying that there was a priest behind her who wasn't a member of the group. Lady Helena, who lived here up until the early 1940s, she had reported some noises in this room, but not anything explicit as a ghostly experience. And she removed the panelling from this room and took it down into another room in the house and found behind it lots of mouse carcasses. So she felt that was a reasonable explanation for some of the things that had been happening in here.
Okay, so, noises of...
Yes.
Yeah, feet.
Yes. But this is one of those rooms where people do sometimes start to feel things.
Have you ever stayed overnight?
I don't. I do live in the house.
Okay.
But I haven't stayed in any of these rooms.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe not.
I had the experience of staying in a similar room in Athelhampton in Dorset, which was quite an interesting experience. Just me and the grey lady.
Oh, gosh. And? Did she appear?
I didn't. No. I didn't look above my duvet most of the night.
Yeah. I think we'd all do that, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, before we leave this room, I have to say you've got some lovely portraits, some lovely, my eye is being drawn to various sort of beautiful, what, Elizabethan, early Jacobean portraits that you have on the walls?
That's right. So we have a portrait of the Halswell children, so six children. Some of them breached, some of them not, so a mixture of boys and girls, and a very prominent baby at the front holding up a coral rattle in his or her right hand. And that was part of the Wharton bequest of paintings, which came to the family in the 1960s. So that's quite a very large picture, probably nearly 5 feet across. So that kind of dominates the room. And then as you draw your eye around, we've got a large supposed Tintoretto, which again was one time linked to this refashioning of the room for Princess Mary. But actually we've got some documentary evidence about it entering the collection a bit later. An amazing painting to find in this little house.
And who is this little...
So that
sweet little
is
girl or boy,
the little girl who would become the Winter Queen. So Anne of Bohemia.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, she's very pretty.
So she's got a little embroidered cap with lots of sort of sweetheart lace framing her face, some fur around the shoulders, and some embroidered black work on the bodice and the sleeves, and some roses and some knots. And she's wearing a very beautiful seed pearl and coral long necklace, and then a silver metal chatelaine, which we can't quite see what the pendant on the end is. It might be a rattle with a little whistle. We can just see the top part in her fingers.
The lace, the quality of the painting of the lace is really exquisite, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's lovely. Yeah. So do you have a full set of... do you know where most of your paintings have come from? Have they got good provenance or is it a bit hit and miss?
It's a bit of a mixture. So we have this large portion of very, very beautiful portraits which came from the Wharton collection, from Baron Wharton. It was a gift to Malcolm Munty. And then we have other pieces that were collected by the family. And one of these is a very small portrait... Mm. And I'm going to have to be vague and give you the detail at some point.
Right, okay.
This was given to Adam Munty's grandfather, Axel Munty, who was a doctor. And he was very skilled in waterborne diseases. And he essentially stopped an outbreak of cholera in Naples. And this small portrait was given as a gift in thanks. And so that's how that entered the family.
So lovely portrait of a man.
A young man with a black, probably velvet cap over this sort of slightly curling, cascading hair and a very direct sideways glance. And then this little slip of white cotton above another black garment, which kind of swathes him. And the light is falling entirely on the face and the hair.
Mm.
So it's probably a portrait of a young man.
Mm. Lovely. Okay. Well, with that, we can say goodbye to Mary's bedroom. And where are you taking us next?
So we're out on a landing at the top of the main staircase, which is supposed to have been carved by the king's carver, John Abel, somewhere between the sort of 1630s, 1640s. And that really dominates the centre of the house. It's quite a plain staircase with these quite odd newel posts, which they're mismatched. So you've got one square cube with a sort of chamfered edge and then one that's much more rectangular. And the tops are completely sliced off. And that's the case all the way up the staircase. So you think that they should have had some kind of... beast or motif or corbel or something on the top, but they don't.
And that's been there, that's always been there
since
nobody's moved the staircase around. That's always been the central main.
So certainly since that sort of day, it probably replaced a much earlier staircase. But the way that it leads you through the house, it doesn't suggest that it significantly changed the layout of the house.
Mm.
And then we go into... probably the largest bedroom in the house, and this is called the Cordova room, and it's named for the leather coverings on the wall.
Yes, spectacular. Gosh, they've got some... have they got some age? Have they been made to look like they've got age?
So we've got four different styles of leather.
on the walls, and some it's very patched and some bits are nailed and glued, and you can see where the Hessian backing is coming through in this. Some patches which are really dark and discoloured and others which are very bright. So you've got this lovely powder blue background with lots of gold and really pretty floral motifs. It's probably 19th century leather, after the fashion from the sort of 1500s in Spain. And became really popular in houses like Oxburgh Hall in Norfolk. That's a really good surviving example of early leather wall coverings. But this almost certainly is a collection of pieces which have been retired from other spaces and reused and probably stored for quite a long time. And in front of them are hung lots of portraits by Charles Jervis and Manner of Lely, and then some examples of late Tudor portraiture as well. And then the main focus of the room is this huge triple bay sash window which looks out onto the Malvern Hills and the meadow beyond. So it's a nice foil, all of this lovely natural light, to the darkness of the leather wall coverings. And then this huge oak carved overmantel, which is also thought to have been carved by John Abel, the king's carver. So you've got a cartouche at the top and then a heavily carved section in the middle with lots of projecting sort of scrolls and loops. It almost looks like the form of a knot garden. And then you've got a series of columns which come down to the side and a mixture of Ionic and Doric columns.
So was this always the principal bedroom, do we think?
When you stand outside and you look at this aspect of the house, so below us is the dining room and we're on a first floor bedroom. And you can see in the bedroom, along with the existing window, which is directly in front of you when you walk through the door, when you look on the outside, behind the fireplace and where the bed is now, you've got some blocked up double height windows, which does suggest that this part of the house originally had a different function and that this first floor didn't exist. So it does look rather like a chapel to me.
Okay.
So that could have been an aspect, and it was this east facing.
Yes.
It's hard to see how, when those windows were in use, how you would have furnished a space, because there is nowhere to put the fireplace or a bed or any other kind of furnishings.
Yeah, and of course you would have expected a chapel.
You would.
In
you
a
would.
House somewhere.
Absolutely.
So there is no surviving chapel here currently.
No surviving chapel.
So one of the paintings, obviously I'm always drawn by the Tudor paintings in a room, and I was drawn to a rather handsome, dapper gentleman staring out at me with his blue eyes. And I wondered whether that was Robert Dudley.
It looks so like Robert Dudley. But we believe that he is Thomas Radcliffe, the Earl of Sussex, after Van der Moylen.
Right, yes.
And he was a fellow courtier and minister at the same time. So whether it's misattributed, and this could indeed be a picture of Leicester, or whether he's following the fashions of the day, because he's depicted with a velvet cap with a red feather and some little gold jewelled or enamelled buttons around the brim of the cap. And then he's got this very high collar on his doublet with a very thin ruff, which completely frames from the back of his head to under his chin. And then his wonderful stripy fabric with some gold buttons and a dark doublet, which this got this huge fur collar. Mm. And then this lovely chain of office with a garter and then a carved intaglio on the front. So certainly somebody who's got access to the best materials and wealth and lots of jewellery. So it's a fascinating picture.
It's gorgeous attire he's wearing. So typical, the jaunty hat on the side, very typical of that period, isn't it? So any other portraits that we need to be paying attention to in here, Sash?
Absolutely. So I would invite you to come and look more closely at a picture of a young woman which hangs to the left of the fireplace. And she is Philadelphia Carey. And this is where we can start to talk more about the Anne Boleyn connection.
Carey. There's a name. There's
That's
a name to
right.
conjure with, yes.
So before we look at her in more detail, on the right-hand side of the fireplace is her uncle, Henry Carey, the illegitimate son of Henry VIII and Mary Boleyn, Anne's elder sister and Philadelphia's uncle. So he has those very piercing blue Tudor eyes.
So this quite is long. Lord Hunsdon.
That's right.
And in later life, obviously, because he's got very silver hair there, hasn't he?
Very distinguished man on a sort of lapis blue background. And all the white of his doublet and his lace collar and his starched ruff and the feathers in his hat all really pop out. And he's similarly wearing a jewelled cap and presumably a garter badge of office. And it's through him that we believe that we have got a portrait and also some objects which belong to Anne Boleyn. And so when Anne was incarcerated in the Tower, she was allowed some of her personal belongings with her, and it is claimed that one of these was a dressing box. And Philadelphia is holding the ivory comb from the dressing box, which we think we have here at Helen's.
Oh, wow.
So she's wearing this incredible costume, which is cut very low on her décolleté. So she's got this expanse of smooth, white, alabaster-like skin indeed on her chest, and it's framed by this beautifully crafted lace collar, which is echoed in the cuffs. And then she's wearing this two-piece outfit of a bodice and a skirt, which is heavily embroidered with pea pods and honeysuckle and leaves and all of this trailing foliage, and there's lots of pink and gold and green against this silk white background. But your eye is drawn to this series of black cords, one of which is around her neck and presumably held a small jewel, and the other one is wrapped around her wrist several times and then culminates in it being attached to a ring which is worn on the left finger.
I was drawn by that. I've never seen that before.
So,
is that a thing? Is that...
It is a thing. And once you've spotted it, you'll start to see it in lots of other things. Okay. So there's sort of two parts to the black cord. One is that it draws your eye, but it's also thought that it indicates that the piece of jewellery the person is wearing wasn't made for them. So it's a kind of security device to keep it on, some sentimental piece of jewellery. But the black cord really draws your eye to it.
It really does. Now, I've come across this portrait, I've come across the story of the comb before. Obviously, I was incredibly intrigued because Anne Boleyn is my historical heroine, and I'd love to think that that was a genuine object.
It certainly has been displayed with the rest of the dressing set as being the property of Anne Boleyn. When you descend the main staircase, there's a very large glazed cabinet which houses the treasures of Helen's. And in it is a large square box, which is mounted with metal on the outside, and inside are all these little divisions, and there's all these materials relating to dress and to grooming, so combs and tweezers and ear scoops and all of those accoutrements of dressing of the time. So that was brought to the family again through the Wharton family.
So when would that have been?
So when it came to Helen's, that was around the 1960s, but it was displayed in the 1800s in London as being the property of Anne Boleyn. And there's a lovely catalogue entry with an engraved image of the dressing box open and some of the parts of it.
Can we go and have a look at
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely, yeah, come with me.
And then I can ask you a little bit more about the provenance and how far back it goes. Inquiries about it?
We don't, and I think that's because the Helen's collection, it hasn't been published, it's not available online. So unless you've actually been to Helen's, you may not know some of the magnificent things that we have to show you.
Wow, look at all of this.
Goodness me. So we've come to a cabinet. It's lit. There are a whole plethora of beautiful objects in here, from coronets to beautiful enamelled. Were they? Is that a hat brooch?
So that's a cap badge.
A cap badge.
So
yeah,
there's
look
a few
at that.
Pieces of male jewellery in this cabinet. So on the left hand side, you've got this circular gold badge, and at the outer edge, you've got four loops, and those would have been used to sew this badge to a cap, or arguably to your doublet. And in the centre, it's enamelled. With these two figures, one of which I think is the Archangel Michael. So that's an unusual survivor of male jewellery. And then we've
that's
got
beautiful.
A book pendant,
yes.
And then a pendant set with rubies, and this wonderful enamel death's head.
Yes.
And then a diamond ring, which does look rather like the one that's being worn by Philadelphia in her portrait. So it's got old cut diamonds, so they're pyramid in form, and quite greyish, although this one does catch the light beautifully if you move around a little
bit. It's absolutely beautiful. And it says
that it's a royal diamond ring given by Charles I to Nicholas Kemys for courage and devotion at the Battle of Naseby. And Nicholas was knighted after the battle in 1642. And nearby there's a portrait of Nicholas wearing this ring. So
you literally have the provenance for that, because
we have a provenance.
A provenance.
But whose handwriting is it in, Sarah?
Malcolm.
Malcolm. It's Malcolm.
Has anybody looked at that, though? I mean, is anybody a specialist in jewellery?
It's a genuine ring, but that's as far as you can really go.
It's really lovely.
So it's got this wonderful gold setting and lots of engraving on the shoulders.
And it really does catch
the
light. It blinds you.
But whether that was actually given in that manner to that person, we just don't know. But this cabinet, one of the really lovely things about it is that it's populated with these little handwritten notes where Malcolm's brought together what he knows, or what he would like you to know, about the objects in this cabinet. So in the centre, we've got the Munti Swedish bridal coronet. And so it's this tiny little headpiece in a gold-coloured metal, and it's surrounded by these sort of trefoil shapes of purple-coloured amethyst-like cabochons, with these little pendants of hearts with white stones that look like diamonds, and those pendants move as the wearer moves about, and that is worn by Munti brides and has been for quite a number of years, although possibly not as long as the 500 that Malcolm would like to suggest. But it's a Swedish tradition that lots of brides wear these little bridal tiaras.
How fascinating. And then we have
the dressing box.
We have the dressing box,
yep.
With the beautiful comb. So tell us about the provenance of that again. How far back does that go?
So that came from the Wharton family, and they made a gift of portraits and other objects to Malcolm Munti in the 1960s. Now, the Whartons were pretty savvy collectors, and they had a great eye, and they were interested in story of objects as well. So they had a family connection, but all we were told really is that this was a box that was meant to have belonged to Anne Boleyn.
Again, has anybody ever sort of like from the V&A commented on it?
Not as far as I know. And it would be fascinating to speak to somebody to see if they feel that this box is the age it's claimed to be, whether the contents inside are original, whether they all match. There's a sort of turned Venetian glass bottle, which might have been an amphora for scent. There's a brush in the middle. There are two ivory combs at the front and a smaller one at the back. And then there's a series of instruments which are just peeping out of their apertures, and they've got sort of turned finials on the end, and they're in a gold-coloured metal, probably a brass alloy or something. And the whole box is decorated. It's a dark-coloured square box with this sort of corally pink interior, and the whole outside is covered in these gold floral motifs with sort of punches.
It's very antique work.
They almost look like carved gems that are set into it. But the whole thing looks to be constructed of some kind of paper that's been embossed with gold, and then there's a sort of tassel at the end, which presumably is for carrying it.
Oh, it's so lovely. Mm-hmm. Look, it'd be wonderful to know.
Mm,
I mean, if this actually was genuine,
if that
was
genuine. Apart
from the books of hours, I'm trying to think what other objects we have of Anne Boleyn's. We've got her books of hours, of course. There are other objects, not necessarily, I think, quite as personal.
I think there is another dressing set, because I saw a historian, possibly Kate Lister or Freya Gowley, who was talking about what we can read into the fact that Henry VIII gifted an ear scoop to Anne Boleyn.
There's a little, it's like it's in the V&A, it's got a little... It's almost like not a locket, it's like little tools, multi-tools.
That's it. It's almost like a Swiss Army knife for beauty.
Yes, that's right.
Is that the sort of gift that you just send someone out to buy? Just get me some gorgeous little thing for this new lady in my life.
Yeah.
Or are we needing something more into it? You know, I literally want to be intimate with you. Is it that? Mm-hmm. So if we have anything which potentially bears the DNA of Anne Boleyn, that could be quite exciting.
Okay, it certainly would be. I mean, that comb is in perfect condition if it has made it through. There's not one, what do you call them?
Tine missing. Tooth.
That's it, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I love the story.
Exactly. That's what we're here for.
Fantastic. So, is there anywhere else we need to go, Sash? Any other interesting nooks or crannies that we need to have a look at?
Well, let's go into a bedroom, which is named for Hetty Walwyn, who is supposed to have lived here in around the 1730s. So we're in a bedroom, and the room's dominated by this central bed, which actually speaks to the architectural development of the house, because it's actually constructed around a frame, which is part of the fabric of the house.
Yes.
So this was probably an exterior wall at some point in time, but now it's got these rich hangings around it.
It's masquerading as a bed.
It is. So there's a story connected to this room that this unfortunate young woman, Hetty or Mahatabel, got together with a gentleman of much lower social status than herself, who's called John. And the story goes that she eloped with John and under some circumstances decided to come back to her family, but that she was allowed to come back, but on the condition that she didn't bring any further shame upon the family. And the solution they found was to place her in this room for the next 30 years of her life. So I was intrigued by this story, and I couldn't find any history of it. It's not mentioned in Lady Helena's biography or anything locally, Arthur Mees, King's England, you know, none of the usual sources. Mm-hmm. The first person I can find who speaks about it is Malcolm. we know a bit about the Walwyn family at the time. She doesn't appear in any of the family trees. No young woman of the right age, no matter what her name, appears there. So it does feel like this is a Malcolm creation, but he's absolutely outdone himself with this one. Because engraved on the leaded windows, which look out into the courtyard, are two lines of text repeated twice, and they're meant to have been scratched by Hetty on the inside of the window, presumably with a diamond.
Can you see it?
In the top middle, and it's also repeated lower down.
Yeah.
And it says something like, I'll paraphrase, if love proves our bane, it would have been better not to have done what I did. So if I had known what I know now, I wouldn't have done what I did. And that's on the inside of the window. So this is presumably after she's come back full of regret for the shame and whatever didn't work out that she came. But to me, the really exceptional second part of this is that on the outside of the glass is some writing which says John Pierce, 1702. So we've kind of got a Romeo and Juliet thing where supposedly Hetty is on the inside of the glass, essentially saying to John, stay away, didn't work out, get over it. And he's on the outside, presumably having climbed a very tall ladder in the depths of night and written his name on the outside of the glass. However, a couple of problems with this story. Not only do we not have a Hetty or any woman of the right age in the family tree, we don't have a grave, we don't have anybody talking about it. My question to you and anyone else is, if you're hiding somebody in a room, do you provide them with a bell Which they can then ring and attract attention from anyone that they like. Okay. And we actually invite...
Oh, my goodness! Oh, let's
Paul.
Have...
There
got,
you go.
I've got to have...
Give it a
I've
bit of welly.
So, yeah, so you can hear this from all over the place.
Yeah, no hiding you at all. Now, you've probably spotted these on lots of other houses, and this speaks back to really what Helen's was. It's a farmhouse. This is a bell to call people who are working in the fields to come back to church.
Right.
So it's in this room, which was probably not even a bedroom when this was installed. So it kind of contradicts the idea that she was incarcerated in here. But it is a story that people feel tremendously attached to. Lots of people come into this room and feel something when they come in here. So maybe there is a presence that Malcolm himself felt and wanted to kind of build on that. Uh-huh. And he's brought together a number of portraits, one of which is this very... this woman who's got her eyes kind of raised, they're slightly glassy, she's deep in contemplation. It kind of looks like a Magdalene picture, but you know, in Malcolm's mind, that really represents an Hetty, presumably thinking back to what might have
the
been.
The desolate heroine of the story.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, and there's lots of engravings in the room and portraits of other people from a similar time. So he's really crafted this room to kind of speak to that story.
That's fantastic. So what happened to Malcolm? When did he die?
So he died in the 1990s.
Right.
So he had a very rich, very long life. And he divided his time between Helens and Southside in London. And he really did the same kind of thing at Southside, where he populated with lots of historic pieces, lots of pieces from the Wharton collection. But he created these tableaus of objects and paintings. So around every corner, there was this, you know, sort of new tableau to enjoy. And if you're familiar with Dennis Seaver's house...
No, I don't know it.
So that's a house in Spitalfields in London. Mm. And Dennis was an artist, and he's taking similar glimpses into history. And then he'll sort of project a picture out in 3D with similar objects as are found in the picture. So that's probably the closest parallel that I can give anyone who's kind of interested in what Southside looked like in Malcolm's heyday.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of our... fascinating, hugely enjoyable tour. You've been a fantastic guide, but maybe people would be interested to know actually what happened to the house after Malcolm. Who cares for it now?
So Helen's is lived in and cared for by a number of families who live here on the estate. It's been lived in that way since at least the 1970s. It is still lived in by members of the Munty family, so they still have that connection here. And it's a place where our ethos is around access to the environment, the arts and culture through education. And we're really a resource for people who want an escape, for people who just want some peace and quiet, but also people who are interested in sustainability. So they're kind of all of our values. But it's centred around this ancient house filled with stories, and we continue to make them and hope to share them in the future.
Oh, yes. Now, well, that brings us to the very practical side of the podcast, which is, you know, how can people access Helen's? When can they come? When do you open? And I'm also aware you do lots of cultural events. You've got, if anybody follows you on Instagram, and I'll go back to saying that it's simply at Helen's Manor, isn't it? Your Instagram
account.
Yeah,
that's right, Helen's Manor.
You'll see all sorts of things coming up, and you do food markets, which look divine. So can you tell us all about, you know, how people can enjoy Helen's?
Absolutely. So if you want to come to the house, we'd love to see you on Wednesdays and Sundays, bank holiday Mondays between April and October. Outside of those times, we can be visited for private tours. If food is your thing, we have a produce market on the first Saturday of every month. We also have a music festival every May where we bring together students and master artists from across the world for a series of concerts. We have a developing concert programme throughout the year, and you can find information for those on the website. And in June, we have a two-day garden festival, which has been running for about 17 years now. And that's really about sustainability. But it's this amazing fundraising event for a local hospice.
Brilliant. And you're responsible for making a lot of this happen?
I help make lots of those things happen. So I'm here. I'm the general manager of Helens. I look after the people who live here, and I oversee the arts and cultural programmes. But there's a whole team of tremendously skilled and passionate people here who really just bring all of their talents and their excitement and their enthusiasm and just make Helens what it is.
That's brilliant. Well, just a massive thank you from me. It's been so enjoyable to learn about Helens and to its many, many stories. And I don't know, maybe we'll unravel some of them in the future. Maybe we won't. They'll just remain an enigma, which might be a nice thing.
So everything's good.
Thank you, Sash.
Thank you, Sarah.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our adventures and our exploration of Helens Manor House. It just goes to show not everything is as it seems when you visit some historic properties. But that doesn't mean to say that necessarily it's any less interesting for it. Well, I hope you get to go along and visit the house. The links that you'll need for the show notes page are, of course, associated in the description associated with this podcast, as is the link to the manor house itself, so the website for Helens itself, so you can keep up to date with all the latest events and how you can visit. All right, well, with that, I'm going to say cheerio, and I will look forward to seeing you in the next episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Stay safe, my friends. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling!